We're in.
Are you saying the first words, Hannah, Dr. Hannah?
Yeah.
Why don't you speak first? And I'll never speak.
I promise you I'll never speak. I'll try to...
I promise you I won't say a word. Hi, I'm Raz Shaw, and I'm a theatre director and lately a bit of a writer. And I've been very close to it three times.
And I'm Hannah Harris, and I'm a doctor, and sadly, I see a lot of it in my job.
In this podcast, we're going to be talking about the elephant in all our rooms.
Death.
Each week, we're going to be speaking to guests we admire and asking them, amongst other things, to curate their own memorial service.
In order to peel back the layers of their life so far.
For me, the existential question of like being an actor and a doctor often resurfaces at my lowest points, especially when I'm in medicine and hating it.
What they do or don't hold dear.
He used to read us proverbs from the Reader's Digest proverb book. And me and my sister were like, we're just trying to have our Rice Krispies, Dad, please. You know.
Their take on their own mortality.
And how they want to be remembered at the end of their lives.
I want people to be really fucking sad.
A kind of desert island death, if you like.
Oh, that's good. So, welcome to our brand spanking new podcast, Death and the Elephant.
Our guest today is Eesh Aladi.
Eesh is a brilliant actor.
Eesh is a really brilliant doctor.
He is, but it's not really a competition, Hannah.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, really? Okay, here we go then. As an actor, Eesh's credits are many and varied, including a host of shows at the National Theatre and the Royal Exchange in Manchester, which is where I first worked with him, on a play called Wit in 2016. In 2019, he won the UK Theatre Award for his exceptional performance in Hobson's Choice, also at the Royal Exchange.
Prior to the pandemic, he was mainly working as an actor, but throughout the last year, he's been working as a doctor on the front line.
Amazing. He's a properly insightful guy, is Eesh, and we had a lovely time chatting with him. Let's have a listen.
So, Eesh, before we come on to talking about mortality stuff, can we just hear a bit about you and your, basically, as far as I'm concerned, what is a dream career, combining medicine with acting and the arts? So, yeah, how did it come about? How did you make it happen?
So, from the age of four, I went to an after-school, like, theatre school. My mum and dad knew that, like, I think it's from performing on the windowsill to singing in the rain and to various Tamil movies and things like that. I think they sort of knew that I was probably wanting to be... I mean, I really wanted to be a dancer. That was the thing. I wanted to be Gene Kelly. It was, like, my dream. So my parents enrolled me into dance school, and I did, you know, all the usual ballet, jazz, tap, modern. I did it for about 10 years in the end. I went to a boys' school, and, you know, boys do not dance.
We do, like, rugby and manly things.
Yeah, especially at the Manchester Grammar School. We do very manly things.
Oh, that's really sad. Your dreams were dashed.
I mean, it didn't take very long for me to find theatre at Manchester Grammar. So I think, yeah, the sort of cloak of invisibility that I thought I had on was not working.
I know, we can see through you. Before you go on to that, so because your family are doctors, right?
That's right. Yeah, everyone's a doctor.
So when you were young, did you just have it in your head that you wanted to be a performer? Or did you ever have it in your head that you might want to be a doctor as well?
I don't really ever actively remembering I wanted to be a doctor. The thing I remember actively wanting was to be an actor. My grandfather loved loads of, you know, black and white movies, you know, from Hollywood, and he just used to watch them all the time, and he brought my mum up on it, and then my mum gave it to us as well. Like, you know, it was a sort of Gene Kelly, Judy Garland, Fred Astaire. I didn't realise how well I knew these movies, like almost like word for word just remembering the script.
Oh, that's amazing.
Watching Singing in the Rain now is like a masterclass in every single aspect of the industry, right? It's kind of extraordinary.
Right, yeah. I literally have in my bedroom a huge like a vintage poster from Singing in the Rain.
There's still time to play that part. So you came out of Cambridge, you became a doctor, and how long into doctoring did your toes start to twitch? You started to miss the smell of the grease paint every night when you lay under the covers listening to those Judy Garland musicals.
Shimmying around the wards.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Tap dancing down ward rounds, yeah.
Oh, that's a great image.
I mean, basically, I remember like when I was doing Singing in the Rain at uni, I to practice the tap, I would be on ward rounds, just like my feet would be fidgeting and just practicing the routines. I think everybody thought I was so annoying.
That's brilliant.
Oh my God.
That's a play right there.
So cutting to, I guess, 2000, I can't remember what it was, 2016? You did a play called Wit at the Royal Exchange that I directed, which is a play about a woman dying of ovarian cancer and how she deals with it and the kick-ass way she deals with it.
It's a riotous comedy.
And in that, you played a doctor, funnily enough. Mm. One of my favourite stories of all time is you waiting in a white coat ready to go on. Someone in the audience fainted and they're being pulled out into the foyer and you went over to them and...
I said, I know I'm dressed like a doctor, but I really am one.
And they're lying on the floor thinking, you're an actor.
Do you need my help?
The poor man looked so freaked out. I think he may have thought he was hallucinating at the time. And then when the paramedics arrived, I also said, I need an ECG and I want a blood sugar. But I said, I can't look at it right now. I need to go on stage. So make sure it's ready for when I get back.
That's fantastic.
So you were literally doing both jobs at the same time.
And in that, there was a doctor who was much more interested in the science of the work than the people, I guess. Did that role affect how you approached doctoring when you went back to it at all, or...?
It really did. I mean, the major thing that I found was that I remember when we were working on it, I was absolutely convinced that, like, oh, I'm a much better doctor than this. I'm nothing like this guy. I'm nice. I'm empathetic. And I think one of the lines that the character used to just, he just to come in and say, you know, how are you doing? And just not really care how are you doing. And then I found myself in my first shift back, and I just sort of brought this patient in, and whilst I was reading the notes, I just went, how are you doing? And then I just went, oh God. And then just gave them as much eye contact as I physically could and just was like, now tell me everything.
Are you okay?
No, tell me, I really mean that. How are you? And overcompensating so much and then going home and, you know, just having an existential crisis over, you know, who am I? Who do I even think I am? it was actually a really pivotal moment for me in terms of my medicine and trying to realize there must be a way of you being who you are to your friends and being that relaxed human being whilst being a professional and having all that knowledge in you and being able to use it in a way that doesn't alienate or distance people. I'm still working on that.
Yeah. Supposedly, as a doctor's career goes on, their communication skills become worse and worse.
Is that true?
They become less and less empathetic. Like, when you're learning communication skills at medical school, medical students tend to be really, really good. And then as their career goes on...
Is that because they just care less or they just slide on autopilot?
Well, I mean, I think you just get... There's just so much more pressure as you go up as well. And you've got so many much more responsibility, so many other things to think about. Also, you don't need to ask a lot of questions sometimes, or as many questions as you used to be able to figure out what must be going on. Is that, do you find that?
Totally. Yes. And you've got the time pressures. You just want to get through as many patients as you can.
Yeah.
And if you stop to give, to sort of show some compassion, it can then take up a lot of time that you don't have.
A friend told me a story of like a medical student who was helping her mum, who really wanted like nice lollies kind of thing, because she was remembered it from when she was a kid. And she mentioned this to a medical student that was looking after her on the ward. But this medical student then spent 4 hours looking for a lemon ice lolly just for this. But I was like, who is that medical student? And who, you know, because you're amazing. And I just hope that they can retain something of that when they become, you know, a fully fledged doctor. Because I think that's incredible. And I wish we had the time to do that. But you just don't, unfortunately.
So cutting to sort of the present day, I read a beautiful thing you said about preparing for the first influx of patients when COVID started. And you said, and I quote, "In the first few weeks, it was like when the tide goes out before the tsunami and the birds stop singing, or before a nuclear explosion when all the air gets sucked out and then there's a moment of silence before the boom," which is an extraordinary thing to say. How did that and the subsequent boom, you know, affect you, I guess?
Yeah, it's still affecting me. I think the wave element of it all, it's a really apt word for what it feels like, the ebbs and flows of not only the patient, but the moods that come with it. Feeling competent, feeling like you are riding the wave, to the moments where you're in that, you know, god-awful trough and you're just, you know, at the bottom of the pit and you're like, I don't know if I'm helping at all. Everyone's just struggling to keep their head above water, to continue the metaphor.
So you start questioning yourself, do you, or what?
I think so. For me, the existential question of like being an actor and a doctor often resurfaces at my lowest points, especially when I'm in medicine and hating it. So some of that is that. Some of that is just feeling not competent enough to save people or help people in the way they need to be helped, being so busy that you are running on adrenaline and having had that, you know, one chocolate for like your tea break, then seeing suffering and death and young people becoming really unwell. You want to seem as a doctor that you're coping, that you're not allowing it to affect you, because that sort of is a professional thing, that I'm immune to this, I can do this, I can rise above this, or something like that. It's have a cup of tea, get back to it, and then that's what happens.
And you kind of feel like you have the pressure because you feel like the patients need you to be there, being the strong doctor who's in control and knows what to do.
Yes, exactly. I had a patient recently, and I'm still sort of dealing with stuff with it, and it was quite a traumatic entrance into the A&E department, and we have quickly realised that we couldn't resuscitate her because of the way she died. It was a suicide. This poor woman was very young. She had two kids, you know. And when you lead a case and when you help, you know, lead a team and things like that, I try to make sure that I went around and checked that everybody was okay without putting too much emphasis on it, because people also just need to get on with their jobs and stuff like that. So there's a, you know, real... And I also hadn't dealt with anything like that in a long time. And so it was really hard. And I think during this pandemic, that's the thing. Like, it's been the loneliness and the word isolation and everything that means and everything that has done to people, I think that's what's been affecting me, really.
And it must have, you know, working in the Northwest in the last few months especially, the second wave has been huge there, and it must have really made you think about your own mortality, other people's mortality, and confront it.
Absolutely. I mean, you're sort of trying to hold on to things that are precious to you. The problem is the isolation thing has sort of gone, well, I can't do that. I think a lot of people experiencing this, like when they're trying to see their families and things like that. And I don't want to put my mother and father in any danger at all. And if I'm going to be in A&E, you know, soaked in COVID, I don't want to be going anywhere near them because the guilt of that, you know, were they to get ill, God forbid, as a result of me entering their house when they've been isolating completely before now, I don't think I could ever recover from that particular kind of guilt. And so it's just not worth risking.
Beyond what you've talked about professionally, what's your relationship been with death up to now? Is it only been professionally, or have you been touched by it personally?
I remember very much, like, my first sort of experience of death was through singing at funerals with the school choir. I remember one particular funeral that we did. It was only a small group of us that were asked to sing. The casket was open because we were in the church, the choir stalls, like looking over this casket that was open. I mean, the school was very good and kind to us and allowed us the rest of the day off when we came back, because it was quite traumatizing. I'd never seen a dead body at that point, and then to suddenly see it there whilst just singing a lovely Ave Maria, it was
the lovely Ave Maria.
It's like, oh
gosh, what a bizarre experience. How old were you?
I must have been 12 or something. Yeah, 12. Yeah. And then going back into maths class after that was not really what I wanted to do. And then I remember, I think my grandmother's death came at a time when, and it's no secret, I suffered with depression, but like it was at a time when my depression was particularly bad. And I remember my grandmother died, and I think it was like a week after that, an aunt and an uncle also died. And I remember being very, very glad for my antidepressants. And then, you know, but as I say, with depression, my own mortality, it sort of comes up a lot, whether you should be here or not, and whether your existence is worth it, which is sort of the thoughts that go through your head when one is depressed.
And there is this link between thinking about death and feeling depressed. And so I do wonder if that's why we're seeing this, an epidemic in depression and anxiety and sadly suicide in the wake or in the midst of this pandemic, is because we're being confronted by illness and mortality all the time, and it's hard for the brain to cope with that.
I think that's right. I think there is that, and I think it's also sort of, not only is it thinking about the sort of the death element, but it's the lack of life element. That's a way, a different way of framing it. It's like, not what is the point of living if this is what is life, you know, because it's not fun.
No, and there's no end.
It's not easy.
In sight.
So beyond your antidepressants, how do you drag yourself out of those moments when you have those moments, or do you?
Self-care. It used to be a very annoying term to me. I never really understood what that means. Oh, you should just look after yourself. And I'm like, all right. And like, I'm trying. like, it's not working.
What do you think I'm doing every day?
Exactly. And obviously that means eating well and drinking well, sleeping well, like, you know, and doing exercise. Those are the real things. That's what sort of self-care on a sort of physical, practical level means. I'm a very busy person, and it's being able to say, it's okay to not be busy. It's okay to sit there and watch the entirety of Disney Plus, and that's okay. You know,
like, you know, you've just outed yourself.
That's okay. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that helped, but also just friends, you know, family, talking. I'm a talker, as you may have guessed, listeners. I then just talking, not necessarily about the stuff that's making me down. And I do talk to my friends about that stuff, but it's talking about just anything and everything, just keeping the conversation going.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's where this podcast came about, is a moment of pausing, of looking back on your life up to now and thinking, have you achieved everything you've wanted to achieve? What might you be remembered for at this point? What have you got left to achieve that you need to live for that you haven't achieved yet? What do you feel, looking back on your life, that are your major achievements, and what are your ambitions from here on in, I guess?
I'm really glad I've done everything that I've done. It all feels like the stepping stone to where I'm going. I'm glad I had the bravery to leave medicine. I'm glad I did it because of the extraordinary happiness that I got into my life and the people that I've subsequently met, and that exists, and that is something that makes me happy.
That's your sliding doors moment.
Yeah, you took the plunge and it worked out. Like, how good must that feel?
I mean, insanely good, but unfortunately I feel like I'm on the other side of the doors right now. But
that's interesting. Does it make it better or worse? You know, if you took the other fork and stayed as a doctor and didn't train, and we got to this point in the pandemic, not took the plunge, you wouldn't be looking and thinking, when's theatre coming back? When's whatever?
The thing with sliding doors moments is, obviously, looking at them retrospectively, you go, well, that I can only imagine. I can only do imaginative leaps to think what would have happened if I didn't go.
Yes.
And where would I be right now?
Because that's a different person who's on that other path.
And that universe, I would like to see and see what that's like. But I think the writing was always on the wall. I mean, I'm telling you that I love Judy Garland musicals at the age of four.
Even if Judy Garland is burning inside you, oh, and Liza Minnelli's not far behind, it takes a lot of courage to step out of what everyone, especially if you're in a family of doctors, you know, to say, I'm stepping out of this now. That takes a lot of courage. I don't think it's inevitable.
It must have felt quite kind of selfish, I imagine, as well, did it?
It's funny because I hear you say that and I wince and I squirm inside because it didn't feel brave at the time. I felt cowardly for not having done it sooner.
Oh, wow.
Mm.
And I guess that leads to the other heart of this question. So when I was ill, not the first time when a hotel fell on top of me, the second time when I was close to death.
Yes.
Oh, it's a great subject. Where in 1995, when I had stage four non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, it was an opportunity to look into death and see what that was. It's something that whenever I used to work at drama schools, I used to do the death workshop. Let's do the death workshop. And I don't think you can be an actor unless you've looked into what that might feel like if you are close to not being here anymore. Anyway, being a bit theatrical, one of the things I did was curate, write down, which I haven't found anywhere, my own memorial service. And that's kind of leading to this podcast, which is given the opportunity when you're alive to, and not for now, in hopefully 40 or 50 years time when you die, because I'm sure you'll be a really old man when you die.
Oh, no. Oh, no. As soon as I lose my mind, I'm going to Dignitas, my friends. Goodbye. She's off.
That's a whole nother podcast. But given the opportunity to curate your own memorial service, I guess the question is, how would it feel? What would be in it? And the bigger question, how do you want to be remembered, I guess?
I've always thought about my funeral. I do think, I know people say they want this celebration and, you know, that's the sort of thing. That I want people to be really fucking sad.
right.
Like, weeping and wailing. Sad that I'm gone. Yeah.
Falling in the aisles.
I want both, really, to be fair. I want rending of garments. I want wailing. And then I want a massive like dance party at the end of it. Do you know what I mean? I want people to like have fun, like, and dance to all of my favourite cheesy songs. Love.
Yeah. So have you thought well, how would you want to be remembered?
I don't know how I would be remembered, but how would I want to be remembered? I think I would like to be remembered as someone who was kind and honest and brave.
Nice.
Those three things. I think, like, those are the things I admire in other people. I could die in peace. I think, yeah, if I achieved stuff, that would be delightful. If I were to be able to do one really good, significant thing, that would be really nice. But then I don't know what that means, to be honest. I think if it was...
No, it's very abstract.
Yeah, I think, and I mean it in the abstract, because it, in a sense that it was so significant that I felt it was significant enough. And in its entirety, like, and I think you know what that is. I haven't felt it yet, I suppose, like, is what I can say to you. So
yeah, we hadn't really talked about what you feel that you have left to achieve, but I guess that's it.
Yeah, I want to do something that sort of feels like I've done it with my entire body and soul and mind, you know what I mean? Like, and something that feels like really reflects me as a human being. But it's about feeling it, isn't it, more than anything, I think.
And I think you're growing as a person and flexing and changing throughout your life, you know, every decade, every year. So you can't possibly predict what that would be now.
Yeah. I think some people, for some people, it's their child sometimes, isn't it?
Mm.
That I've brought this amazing human into the world, or they're part of me. That's, you know, that's a clear legacy, a genetic legacy. I mean, I don't have that on the horizon necessarily, but like the, but so you sort of go, well, what would my legacy be, you know, without that? I mean, it would be through work, I suppose.
A legacy is also about the humanity in some way.
Absolutely. I don't know, the measure of a person is about their CV, no. Ultimately. And I, you know, as much as like, William Shakespeare and his plays and all of that, he's got a wonderful legacy. Well, we don't know if he was a twat, do we?
I think we do.
That's such a good point.
I think we do know.
Like, oh, he definitely was a twat, but like, yeah. But, you know, but you just go, great for him that he's remembered by his plays.
I guess when we talk memorial service or funerals, we want to recognise the person in the content that's in it.
Yep.
So have you thought about what might be in it and what that means to you and what that would mean to the people who were there?
There would definitely have to be lots of musical theatre, I imagine, because that's what I live my life on.
This memorial service could go on for hours.
It could absolutely. I mean, a massive Sondheim fan. And I was thinking, what song would that be? And I was like, maybe, I mean, my favourite song is Being Alive. And I thought that would not be great.
Oh my God, that is good. No, that's the
perfect.
Opposite.
And then moving on to Move On. It's just like,
well, you've got
to
have a walkout.
That's the next thing, you know, like, everybody leave, move on.
And would there be any readings in this memorial service?
There's readings that mean a lot to me. It's a thing written by a man called Max Ehrman. And it's sort of like a way to live your life. And it starts, go placidly amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. And it goes on to sort of say, you know, try to be on good terms with people, talking about love being as perennial as the grass. And the last couple of lines, this is what I always love, is that like, with all its sham, drudgery and broken dreams, it's still a beautiful world. Strive to be happy. My dad used to read it to me and my sister at the breakfast table, and we had it stuck on the fridge.
No, that's amazing. At the breakfast table.
Yeah, he was amazing. My dad, he's amazing. Sorry, I'm just saying, like, he's died. He hasn't. He's very much alive.
Oh my God, he's so alive.
He used to read us proverbs from the Reader's Digest proverb book, and then tell us what it meant, and read, you know, passages and poems, and try to explain them. And me and my sister were like, we're just trying to have our Rice Krispies, Dad. Please,
we're trying to read the cereal box. Like, shut
we don't want to go to school. Just leave us alone.
Just to tell our listeners that your dad is amazing. I mean, both your parents are amazing. Your dad is amazing, and he was he an anaesthetist?
He is an anaesthetist. Yeah.
He's like the Godfather. And when I had this trouble with a consultant in Critical in January, he phoned me up on the ward phone and basically said, I know everybody. Is there anything I can do to help? And I didn't really want this, a horse's head in the doctor, in the consultant's bed the next day. But he's an incredible man. So just the thought of him reciting those things over breakfast and stuff is amazing.
He sounds like an absolute legend.
He really is, yeah. I mean, he annoys the hell out of me as well, don't get me wrong.
Of course. His name is Father meant to after do. All.
Yes, exactly. But he's a poet at heart, I think. He has a lot in him that he wants to give to the world. And I think he's always struggling to find his way of communicating, I think. He does it through poetry. Tries to do it through giving advice and helping people. I think that's what he's always done. Yeah, he's amazing. The other passage I was thinking about, actually, coming on to that, is another poem that he used to read, which Tagore wrote. I think he wrote it for when India gained its independence, and it's called Let My Country Awake.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful poem that sort of talks about a country where the mind is without fear, where people allow, you know, the clear stream of reason to exist, and all this. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem, and it's filled with hope of like what a kind of world one could live in. And I think my dad said it is one of his favorite. And at the minute, I do sort of read it a lot, just because it does fill me with some hope. Like, what is that called? It's Let My Country Awake. By Rabindranath Tagore. The last one, actually, and sort of like one of my favorites is do you know the book A Little Life? It's a great book by Hanya Yanagihara, but there's this really wonderful passage in it about friendship, which I think, you know, it talks about the only trick of friendship being to find people who are better than you. not smarter or cooler, but kinder and more generous and more forgiving, and to appreciate them for what they can teach you, and to trust them, which is the hardest thing of all, but it's the best as well. Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Well, I can't wait for your memorial service. This is going to be great.
Some really inspirational speeches.
It's going to be a great one.
Yeah, we both want to be there.
I'm sure you will. Hopefully not, you know.
I won't. Dr. Hannah, you'll be there. I won't be there.
Well, I'm not sure. Ish is the youngest.
One of the things, almost to round off, is that how important laughter is. I know it's something
I love it, yeah.
and in all those dark times, and even in the last year, is that something you connect with?
I think it's the thing I find most attractive in another human being is their humour. I think, you know, and being able to laugh with them. I think that's the first thing I look for. It's who I'm definitely friends with, is people who can make me laugh. And I say most of my friends are definitely funnier than I am. And that's great. And it means that I spend my life laughing. And I'm quite an easy audience too. I mean, I laugh at myself.
You are a fucking great audience.
It does not take a lot for me to laugh. I love it. I suppose it's that deep guttural laugh out where you're falling on the floor crying, which some of my friends have definitely reduced me to. You know, and I love them so much for
that. We certainly need that right now.
Yeah, definitely the best medicine, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, hugely.
Yeah, who needs doctors when we've got laughter, right?
Absolutely, exactly, right. My problem is that my humour is sort of like veers towards the gallows humour. So at work, it's probably not the best kind of, you know.
Do doctors pretty much have dark sense of humour, especially in A&E.
Especially the ones I like as well. It's not being disrespectful. We're just trying to get through, obviously. And, you know, and I hope nobody sees it that way, because it really isn't referring to anyone specific, but, you know.
Certainly as a patient, I certainly think the doctors and nurses I relate to the most, well, aren't always actually the people who make you laugh, but the people who clearly have a sense of humour. I much more want them to make me better, but as long as they sort of get it, and you can imagine what sort of a patient I am. I'm trying every trick in the book to get a cheap laugh from anybody, doctor, nurse, porter, anybody. I'll try my best. If I find a target that I know will laugh.
And this is why I love you, Raz.
That's the way to get through for me as a patient. Mm. So if you're a doctor and you're dealing with that all day long, there's no surprise that's your way to get through too.
It goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. It's about seeing a whole human, and it's about being present, allowing yourself to give something of yourself to your patient or to the other person. I mean, it's true for any human interaction, ultimately. I think you can frame it as vulnerability. It is certainly a vulnerable position. If you present yourself as a full human being in any interaction and being present in the moment, then another person cannot but trust you.
Yeah, because you're being true to yourself.
Authenticity, I think people really respond to, well, a human being, and I mean, and a doctor especially.
Yeah, totally. And not taking yourself too seriously. Absolutely. Except when the moment requires, I suppose.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
The thing is that the people, certainly the people I warm to, are the people who take their job absolutely seriously. Whatever their job is, they but don't take themselves seriously in relation to that.
Another director friend of mine. Sorry, not you, Raz.
You've got another director
another
friend.
Director.
What the fuck is going on?
No, no. I remember he said something really wonderful, which like I think he used it in.
Oh, he said something wonderful.
I know it was a really wonderful. It was a great note actually that I'll always have. but I think he was talking about notes in general, but and not to worry about them necessarily, but also just it's a very good thing for life, which is. Hold on tightly, let go lightly.
Yes. Oh, that is beautiful. You're giving us some nuggets today, aren't you, Ish?
Thanks. This is what I'm here for.
Well, it's interesting. An artistic director once came to see a run-through of... Actually, it was at the Globe of Midsummer Night's Dream I did. It wasn't that funny in the rehearsal room. I knew that there were some really good actors and there was something that could emerge. And he came to watch it, the artistic director, and he said... that characters in a Shakespeare comedy wear their pain lightly.
Yes.
And that suddenly made sense. It made sense to me and it made sense to all of us. And suddenly you still have to play the truth of those moments, but it's the way you wear them.
Yes.
That
totally.
Defines whether it's a tragedy or it's a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Oh, definitely. That's a great... I love that. I think that's brilliant.
He had to come up with another director note that was as good as yours.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I had to trump him. I had to get my own back.
Well done, Raz. Well done.
I don't know about you, Hannah, but I mean, I could talk all night, really.
Yeah, we know.
No, I don't mean I could talk all night. I mean, I feel I'm being bullied a little bit. I can talk. We could talk to Ish all night.
Yeah, we really could. We could have a whole season of podcasts just featuring you.
Oh, I'll come back.
I'd love that. I love that. Let's do it.
What happens after death? Here we go. We haven't talked about the elephant, though. I mean, guys.
There's a big elephant in the room. Don't look behind you because it's right there. So, I mean, there are a lot of amazing podcasts about death. And hopefully this is something... in terms of celebrating a life before your life is over and looking at your mortality and looking into how that makes you feel and how that makes you live your life. Hopefully we can still be breaking those taboos and beating the elephant out the door.
Absolutely.
I can fight that elephant. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ish.
Thank you to you both. I appreciate it.
It's been a joy and a pleasure. I'd like to say that if anyone wants any horse's head in anyone's bed, Ish's father, the godfather, will take care of it.
He will get it done for you.
He will get it sorted.
Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair and ruin your sleep.
Go placidly amid the noise and the haze, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons.
Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell.
Speak your truth quietly and clearly, and listen to others, even to the dull and the ignorant. They too have their story.
Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here.
Someone to crowd you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through, who will always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. alive. Being alive.
And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive Him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace in your soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be cheerful. Strive to be happy.
You've been listening to Death and the Elephant, an Elephant production. Produced and edited by Harry Winteringham, music composed by Mark Melville, and featuring Dr. Hannah Harris and Raz Shaw. Being Alive was written by Stephen Sondheim and sung by Dr. Isha Lardi. Desiderata was written by Max Ehrman and read by Dr. Romana Alardi.